This is Abby, and welcome back to the Lake Health and Wellbeing Podcast. Today, we have a really interesting episode for you. We'll be speaking to Lanice Brothers, who is the founder of Eat Love Move. Eat Love Move is a business that focuses on women's health and offers personalized hormonal health programs and workshops. Lanice is a registered nutritional therapist who specializes in women's health, anxiety, depression, and weight loss. Lanice's mission is to help women understand and embrace their hormones and menstrual cycle, and therefore much of her work focuses on women who struggle with low energy, sugar cravings, and hormonal issues such as PMS, PCOS, endometriosis, fibroids, heavy and painful periods, perimenopause, and menopause. In today's episode, we speak to Lanice about fibroids, diet, lifestyle, and much, much more. Stay tuned, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
So hi, Lanice. Welcome to our new podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very, very welcome. It's a pleasure. So I guess let's just get into it. So for all our listeners out there, do you want to tell them a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So I am a registered nutritional therapist, and I'm also a health coach. And I've started a nutrition and well-being practice that specializes in working with women who specifically want to get to grips with hormonal issues. And on the surface, this might be women with sugar cravings, mood swings, bloating, or acne. But then once you dig deeper, it's really about things like PMS, fibroids, PCOS, endometriosis, missing periods, irregular periods. So really it really runs the gamut of anything to do with menstrual and hormonal health for women.
Okay, that's great. And that's so important, because I think we just don't have an idea or understanding really of our menstrual health. So I think this is such important work.
Yeah, it is amazing how I find it so fascinating that it's not more widely taught in schools, you know, just the basics of what you know, even the four stages of our menstrual cycle, you know, how things change as we get older. It's incredible, and I really hope that this starts to change and it's added to the health curriculum in schools.
Yeah, well, I think I saw I'm somewhere recently that Endometriosis UK are campaigning for menstrual well-being to be taught in school, so you never know, that might actually come to fruition.
Ooh. Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed, because that would be so helpful. Can you tell us a little bit about what motivated you to start the work that you're doing?
There was a bit of a personal motivation, because I had used food and lifestyle changes to change my own general health and menstrual health. So I've always been interested in food and health. And I used to suffer from pretty debilitating period pain, hormonal mood swings, and I used food to kind of turn things around. And then I started thinking, well, you know, maybe there's a career in this. So I retrained, and then I realized that, you know, there was such a huge opportunity to help women feel empowered about their health, help them better understand their bodies, their hormones, and really take control of their health. So that's really what motivated me to do what I do.
Okay, great. That's really interesting to hear. And I'm just like you. In my 20s, my periods were a complete and utter nightmare. Since gotten better. I don't know. I'm not quite sure why. I don't know if it's age or just the fact that as I've gotten older, I've gotten healthier. But they're so much better now. So I guess what we want to talk to you about in this podcast is really about fibroids, specifically hormones and diet. So I suppose we could start really at the beginning. How do hormones contribute to the development of fibroids?
So I think, you know, at a base level, fibroids are really about an imbalance between estrogen and progesterone. And really it's about, because you always want to have a balance between those two sex hormones. And then when you have high estrogen levels in relation to progesterone, that's when you typically start to see things go a bit wrong. So in some women, it might manifest in simply having PMS, heavy periods, but in some women who have a genetic predisposition to fibroids, that's when you see them start to grow. And then you, in combination with lifestyle factors where you have, you know, excess alcohol, excess caffeine, excess synthetic hormones, you know, it's all in connection with the liver as well, where you see the liver almost being overloaded and not being able to detoxify all of the hormones it's being bombarded with. And then, so you have that genetic link, and then some women, it just manifests in the growth of fibroids.
And I guess the hormonal imbalance, so like you said, lots of different factors can contribute to the hormonal imbalance, and food can be one of those. So I just wondered if you could talk to us a little bit about food and how food affects our hormones.
Yeah, I think what I found so fascinating is that I don't think people realize how powerful food is. Wow. You know, we eat 3 meals a day, sometimes 2 snacks. So, you know, at every time we eat, we're putting things into our bodies. And if you're eating a good diet, then, you know, you're giving your body lots of vitamins and minerals, things that it needs to keep going. But more often than not, I see a lot of people who they're not necessarily eating an optimal diet. So they're not getting enough leafy green vegetables. They're not getting the cruciferous vegetables like broccoli or cauliflower or asparagus, those liver-friendly foods that help detoxify hormones. And then also those foods that help keep us regular, because, you know, it's not just about the compounds for the liver, it's also about the fiber. And that keeps us regular. So we need that, because, you know, constipation is so prevalent, and it's so damaging for women, because we need to excrete our hormones. And for some reason, there seems to be this really common notion that it's normal to empty your bowels every, say, 2-3 days.
Oh, wow.
Really, you need to be emptying at least once a day, if not twice. I had a lecturer once who said that the ideal situation would be if we emptied our bowels after every single meal.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
So that means we're not really, well, most of us then, the vast majority of us, are not getting rid of the toxins in the way that we should be.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, the ideal situation is to wake up in the morning, and as soon as you wake up, you go to the bathroom, you empty your bladder, empty your bowels, and that kind of starts you from not necessarily zero, but that gives you a good starting for the rest of the day, because, you know, at least you've cleared the excess hormones that your liver has been detoxifying overnight.
Wow, I had not realized that at all. Every meal.
Yeah.
Wow. And I'm pretty sure majority of people don't do that. And I guess that's just literally down to the fact that we're not eating enough fiber.
Yeah, we're not eating enough fiber, but we're also not eating the right kind of fiber. So I'm not talking about having a bowl of bran flakes or having like Metamucil. It's really about getting fiber from food. So fruits, from vegetables, from really high quality grains. And that's what keeps us regular.
So that's a note to everybody. Eat lots of fruits and vegetables. Keep regular so that we can get our toxins out.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess back to kind of food and hormones. So are there particular foods that, I guess a lot of people, they ask us a lot about foods that contain hormones themselves or phytoestrogens or various different things. And are those the kinds of foods that people should be avoiding?
Okay, that's an interesting one because there's so many schools of thought on this. And, you know, you'll hear some people who say completely avoid all phytoestrogens. So avoid soy, avoid flax, anything that has phytoestrogens or the compounds that make up phytoestrogen. And I think that you can have phytoestrogens, but you need to be really aware of the type. So I would never recommend that a client has like soy milk or soy cheese or any of those sort of really highly processed soy products. I do recommend, and it's all within a protocol, that certain clients have things like flaxseed. Okay. Because, I think, you know, when I have a seed cycling program protocol that I use with some of my clients to help them get their hormones back in balance. And I do recommend them having a tablespoon of flax in combination with pumpkin seeds in the first 14 days of their cycle, because that helps correct any estrogen imbalance. And then the second half of the cycle is where you're addressing progesterone, bringing that into balance. So kind of to just to round up this thought, I'm not completely against soy. I think fermented soy is fine, generally less processed, and the fermentation really has beneficial effects. So things like fermented tofu, miso. So you look at the Japanese diet, and they have so many of these things in their food, and they don't really have things like estrogen dominance or any of the diseases that we're seeing in the West. I mean, they are having them more and more now that a Western diet is starting to be introduced. On a very traditional level, those fermented soy products are very good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's interesting because I don't know how it all went horribly wrong that these soy products like soy milk became so common in the West. And I just remember reading an article saying exactly what you're saying, is that there was a huge misunderstanding in the way that Japanese people consume soy, and they literally just have usually consumed fermented soy. So I just wondered where it all went wrong. Do you have any ideas of how it all went wrong or this misunderstanding around soy came about?
I think part of it is where people started to look for an alternative to dairy. And then soy, I think it's very different now, certainly in the UK, because you have so many other alternatives. You have almond milk, cashew milk, hazelnut milk, coconut milk. But, you know, say, you know, 5-10 years ago, soy was the alternative if you couldn't have dairy. And so people got it into their heads that soy was healthy. And then, you know, you have vegetarians who, you know, really go whole hog with soy and go, you know, with tofu. And then you have all the soy cheeses and all the various soy products. And all of that kind of adds up to, you know, a potential storm of estrogen issues.
So I guess for women, I guess we could divide women into two here. So for women who already have fibroids, and then we have women who maybe want to be more healthy and prevent fibroids, what advice would you give them in terms of diet? So if you started with women who already have fibroids, what sort of advice would you give them around how to make simple changes to their diets to help them with estrogen dominance?
Yeah, I'd say it's the kind of fundamental is always about making sure you're getting at least 7 to 10 portions of vegetables and some fruit every day. And really within those portions, really making sure that at least 3 or 4 of those are leafy greens. So we're talking about kale, spring greens, winter greens, watercress, bok choy, and then cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, Brussels sprouts. And those I mentioned earlier, those are really have those compounds that help you clear the excess estrogen that is so prevalent with fibroids. But I think that would also be, that's also helpful for women who just generally want to eat healthy. They need to, all women need to clear hormones. And I'd say, you know, generally women, you know, eating the standard Western diet are not getting enough, aren't eating enough vegetables. And if they are eating vegetables, it tends to be things like sweet corn, carrots, and there isn't really that emphasis on having enough greens, having enough of those like cruciferous vegetables.
Okay, okay. So that's really good to know. So 7 to 10 vegetables a day and some fruit. Anything else that women should really try and focus on? I think one thing that we get questions a lot about is things like chicken, because people are concerned that the chickens might have been injected with hormones, and just meat in general. We get a lot of questions about that. So what are your views on that?
So I'm not anti-meat. Mm-hmm. I'm very much about looking at the diet on an individual level. And I think a lot of people, they're surprised when I say that because they expect a nutritionist to be really pro-vegetarian, pro-vegan. And my view is that, you know, some people are natural vegetarians, natural vegans, and some people do better on a diet that contains meat. I think what's really important for especially women with fibroids who are prone to have really heavy bleeding when they're menstruating is to get their iron levels checked and make sure that they're eating iron-rich foods. Okay. So if you're a meat eater, then, you know, getting high quality meat. I know that not everyone can afford, you know, free-range organic chicken or beef or lamb. So the highest quality meat that you can afford within your budget would always be best.
Okay. That's really interesting, because I think other nutritionists that we've spoken to have been like, no, cut out the meat, completely cut it out. So that's good to have a balanced view from you on really around meat. So that's really helpful.
I just say one more thing about that. I think just for vegetarians, really making sure that you're getting that full range of iron-rich foods is really important, because there's two different types of iron that you get, and only meat contains that heme iron, which is very easy for the body to absorb. So with vegetarians, you have to have a little bit more iron, and you need to make sure you're eating it with vitamin C so the body is absorbing it.
Okay. I guess the thing that comes to mind is it feels like the sort of hormone balance, estrogen dominance feels very complicated. And so I wondered, I guess, first of all, how a woman would know maybe she has a hormone imbalance. Are there sort of clear symptoms clear things that she can identify that would maybe demonstrate that she might have some sort of hormone imbalance?
That's a great question. I'd say that women, I would love for all women to be tracking their cycles so they know when their period is coming, and then they can start to see what's happening in the week before their periods. So generally, if you're seeing acne in the week before your period, if you're starting to feel really melancholy or a bit despairing in the week before your period, if you're getting bloating, your energy has gone to the floor, you're getting headaches, you're getting really strong sugar cravings, all in the week before your period, that's a sign that something is going on with your hormones.
Okay.
And you know, you're tracking your cycle and really being able to pinpoint what's happening in the week before your period would give you some clues as to whether there's some sort of hormonal imbalance. I know then you, if you want to, you can go down the road of testing just to see exactly what's going on.
And I guess just to finish off this little segment on diet, I think you mentioned it earlier, but are there like foods that women should, particularly women with fibroids, should definitely avoid? I think you mentioned alcohol, caffeine. Is there anything else that they should avoid?
Yeah, so really highly processed foods, those should definitely be avoided. Fast foods, so, you know, going, you know, having McDonald's every day. Soda, I just generally would love for all of my clients to just stop drinking soda.
Everybody stop drinking soda from this day forward.
So conventionally farmed meat and dairy, because, you know, they're generally, depending on the country and the regulations in that country, but generally they tend to be injected with hormones and antibiotics. And okay. So for a woman with fibroids, that's just, you know, that can add to the issues.
So I guess the main thing with processed food, is it just that processed foods have a high chance of having some kind of hormone in them, or is it just other issues that you're worried about with processed foods?
I'd say highly processed foods, you know, talking like sweets, crisps, they tend to have a lot of some really unhealthy fats, so trans fats. They tend to have a lot of sugar in them. They tend to have a lot of additives. And, you know, just generally speaking, they just make you feel really, they cause blood sugar imbalances. And when you're trying to balance your sex hormones, part of that is balancing blood sugar as well. Okay. And really adding in the fruits and the vegetables and reducing the processed foods.
Okay, great. So no processed foods at all. So we'll make a list in the show notes of the types of foods that people should avoid. So alcohol, caffeine, and no processed foods.
And no soda.
And no soda. And no soda. Okay, great, great. So that's really clear. And just maybe explore with you maybe other lifestyle factors that might be contributing to hormonal imbalances and then could therefore increase a woman's risk of developing fibroids.
So something that I don't think gets discussed enough is the effect of what we put on our skin and what we clean our house with. So, you know, our skin is our largest organ, and what we put on our skin, we absorb, and it needs to be detoxified through our livers. So if you think about skincare, makeup, you know, all of that adds to our hormone load, and it adds to the load that the liver needs to detoxify. Then on top of that, if you add cleaning products, so, you know, just kind of conventional cleaning products that contain a lot of bleach, perfumes, it just, you're inhaling them. Again, it's adding to the load that it's adding to the work of the liver. Something else that I would love to talk about is actually tampons and pads, because if you think about the amount of, I think it's something like the average woman uses about 4,000 tampons.
Yeah, we've written about this in a couple of blogs. Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah, and if you think about the average woman using, you know, the kind of mainstream tampon brands, which are bleached and then You know, and then the cotton is sprayed with loads of pesticides, and then you're putting them up into your vagina, which is highly, highly absorbent. Again, adding to that hormone load. This ultimately isn't for everyone, but I would love for your listeners to think about switching to a menstrual cup. But if that's not for you, or if you're not ready to go there yet, because, you know, that can be a journey. I get it.
It's interesting because we had our fibroids conference about 2 years ago, and somebody put their little hand up and was like, does anybody use the moon cup? And people were looking at her like, what is the moon cup? So that started a whole discussion on menstrual cups. Which I think was very enlightening for a lot of people, and people described some of the downsides of the moon cup, which it can be a bit fiddly and a bit messy. So I think that puts people off a little bit, but I think the general consensus is once you get used to it, it's absolutely fine. I don't know what you think.
I totally agree with that. I personally use a menstrual cup, and I've been using one for the last 3 years, and it just changed my menstrual health in a positive way. Yeah. Because I was still having, even though I had changed my diet and I was doing lots of different things to improve my menstrual health, I was still having issues and I couldn't figure out why. And then I kind of had a light bulb moment where I was like, okay, maybe it has something to do with using tampons. I switched to a menstrual cup, and it just made a world of difference. Just, you know, not only in my menstrual health, but also just kind of the connection to my body and being able to really know my flow. I've gotten over the kind of squeamishness and the blood. You kind of just have to get over it.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny, it's almost like we're so scared of our bleeding and we're so squeamish about it, but it's a natural thing.
So. Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it happens every woman from the age of 13 to, say, I don't know, 50, 55 will bleed at least every month. So, you know, we've got to get comfortable with that.
Exactly. And I wish we would get more comfortable with it. I think the conversations we have about it are just so negative. So I think it's time that we probably have a more positive conversation about our periods, because it's so needed. But I suppose other options, if people aren't comfortable with that's the brand name, with a menstrual cup. So other options are like organic, I think they're organic pads and tampons.
Yeah, so organic pads and tampons. There's some really great brands out there. Like there's a brand called Organics, there's a brand called Natura Care. I'm sure there's loads of other brands popping up, because this is such a huge area. I know that there are some women who they use reusable pads where they kind of sew them at home, and then they will have like a whole stash, and then they wash them in a separate load to everyone else. But again, that requires you to be super comfortable with your blood. But that's a very cost-efficient option.
Yeah, sounds like it. It definitely sounds like it. So, I mean, there are lots of options out there. So there's the menstrual cup and organic tampons and pads and reusable. So there are quite a few options out there. Yeah. And I guess just in terms of the changes that we can make, you've outlined quite a few. So even if somebody just made one change, which is, okay, I'm going to now use more organic, environmentally friendly cleaning products, that will probably make quite a huge difference in terms of hormone to health.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we had the Twitter chat, there was a lady who said that she made a change to her skincare.
Yes,
and she could see a huge difference.
Yes, she did. That's true. And I think we probably don't realize the the difference these things can make, because we're so used to using all these products. So in terms of hair and beauty products, are there particular things that people should be looking out for, particular ingredients that they should be avoiding? There's always talk about parabens and BPA and all sorts of things. Are there any particular ingredients that people should be avoiding?
Yeah, so those two that you've mentioned, you've got sodium lauryl sulfate, so SLS, SLES. There's a whole range of ingredients. Some are not great and some are really very toxic. What I like to do is there's a couple of apps that I like to run any products that I'm thinking about buying through. There's an app called Think Dirty.
Okay.
And there's another one called Skin Ninja. And what they do is you scan, you use your phone and you scan the barcode and it brings up the list of ingredients and it kind of does a stoplight sort of system or rating system to tell you actually what's in these products. Because, you know, a lot of the beauty industry and the skincare industry is so, it doesn't have the same level of regulation that as the food industry. So a lot of these things don't necessarily go through the same level of testing as they would if you were, you know, if it was food. These apps are a great way to check what's actually in the products that you're using.
Okay, great. I like that. So what I'll do is I'll Google those and then I'll put a link in the show notes so that people can download them and maybe test them out.
Yeah. I think it's definitely worth testing.
Thanks for sharing that. That's really helpful. Really, really helpful. So before I move on to the next segment, which will just be a little bit about specifically what you do in your program, is there anything else about diet food that you'd like to just mention that we haven't touched on, and hormones?
I think something I'd really like to emphasize is that, you know, little changes can make a huge difference. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the change that the lady made to her skincare. But, you know, little changes like just adding a portion of greens to a meal. And then just, you know, slowly but surely increasing. You know, my ideal situation is to eat 7 to 10 portions of vegetables every day. But I know that's a lot for some people who aren't even used to eating one portion, or their portion of vegetables is chips or mashed potatoes. So, you know, just making one little change and then you just keep doing it and then it becomes a habit can make a huge difference.
Yeah, and I think it just requires a bit of creativity, because my husband and I recently actually have just pretty much changed our diet. We're trying to eat less meat, more vegetables. And the other day I just found a fantastic recipe, which I would never have thought to do, which is it's like a vegetarian version of sweet and sour chicken, but instead of chicken, you use broccoli. So you cut up the little broccoli pieces and then you kind of make like a sweet and sour, crispy dish with it, and it was so nice. And I just kept thinking to myself, I would never have thought to do that. And I think people run out of ideas of what to do with vegetables, and so I think it does require a bit of creativity and maybe a little bit of research to find out interesting dishes that you can make.
I totally agree. I think you can be so creative with vegetables, and there are so many resources on the internet, so many amazing vegetarian blogs that give you really great recipes, even if you're not a vegetarian but just want to eat more vegetables. I personally like, there's a really great blog called Chocolate for Basil.
Okay, Chocolate for Basil.
And there's another one called Sweet Potato Soul.
Oh, okay. I like the sound of that. Sweet
potato. They're both vegetarians. I think one of the ladies is a vegan, but, you know, just going on and getting some ideas.
Yeah. And it's amazing how creative people have been, because I even saw a cashew, they call it a cashew cheesecake. So it's made of cashews. And I just thought that's so creative. So there's so many really tasty alternatives. So really good. Okie dokie. So I think what we'll do now is just move on to a little bit about the work that you do. So I guess if you could just tell us a little bit more about how you would work with a woman with fibroids. So I know that you have various different programs. So if a woman with fibroids approached you, what kind of work would you do with them?
Yeah, so I generally work with, so I have hormone health programs, and they're tailored to the individual client, where I look at her health history, her lifestyle, but also her personality and, you know, her attitude towards accountability and personal expectations. Mm-hmm. And then I develop a program and recommendations that are tailored to her. Generally, what I'm looking to do is across three parts is repair the nutrient status of the client, because generally I find that my clients are low in iron, they're generally low in zinc, really looking at the gut health, because there's a strong connection between gut health and liver health and hormone health. And I look at the diet in general. Then I also look at rebalancing hormones. Then I look at rebuilding sleep hygiene, really, if there are any issues there. And then also addressing stress and stress management and kind of self-care. I know that term is so trendy right now.
Yes.
but it's fundamental. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely fundamental, especially when you're dealing with women who have been just carrying this burden of pain, often in silence for so long, just talking to them about little things that they can do to take care of themselves. And I'm not talking about going to the spa every weekend. That would be nice. I'm just talking about simple things like remembering to breathe. Most of us we breathe in this really shallow breath from our chest. You know, taking a deep breath that comes from your belly, you know, in deep inhale from your nose, it can really shift how you feel, and shift you from this kind of really anxious, stressful, kind of like running through your to-do list state to more of a kind of a state where you have a bit more perspective. So it's things like that where, you know, I look generally across these three phases, but it's a really taking a really holistic, personalized view of my client, her lifestyle, what's actually going on in her life at the moment. Because, you know, it's nice to say to a client, eat this, do that, you know, sleep like this, but there's no perfect situation. No,
exactly. Go to bed at 8, wake up at 3. Oh, that's really good though. I really like the holistic kind of approach and just looking at the woman in totality, because I think generally speaking, when you go to the GP, they need to focus on one issue. So I think it's nice that your approach looks at the whole person. So that's really, really good. And I suppose we didn't really talk about stress and sleep. So you mentioned stress and sleep just now, and I wondered just how much of a contribution stress and sleep may play in terms of hormonal imbalances and increasing risk of fibroids.
I'd say that stress and sleep I wouldn't say they play a role in the risk of fibroids, but they can contribute to hormonal imbalance that drives fibroids.
Yes.
So, you know, if you think about cortisol, it comes from the same pathway as our sex hormones. So if you're constantly stressed, that can have an impact on your sex hormones like estrogen and progesterone. And then sleep. Sleep is so fundamental. you know, most of us, I think we skimp on sleep and we think that we can get by on 6 hours, 5.5 hours, when the reality is that less than 6 hours of sleep a night is sleep deprivation.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And I was really shocked when I first heard that. And then I had to really reevaluate my sleep habits, because I've always been the type of person that I can just get by on no sleep and I just power through. But then when I looked at my sleep, I really started to look at the time that I was going to bed and the time I was waking up, it made a real difference to the way, to my blood sugar balance the next day, because, you know, sleep has an effect on our hunger hormones, and it can cause slight lack of sleep can cause slight insulin resistance. And so, you know, all of these hormones, they're all in kind of interplay with each other. So, you know, you're not getting enough sleep, you're hungrier the next day, you're more likely to crave sugar, you're eating more sugar, that contributes to inflammation. Inflammation drives pain, which if you have fibroids, you know, you definitely, you know, that can make your periods even worse. So it's kind of a cycle. So you get into the basics, which is about food, stress management, sleep, movement, not necessarily exercise, but it's movement, general movement, moving your body every day, and then food. Oh, I said food, self-care.
And I guess by self-care, you just mean people just making sure that they take care of their mental well-being, they're happy, they're relaxed.
Yeah, exactly. It's about don't put yourself last. I think it's a classic example of women, if you're at the kind of cookout or the, you know, the buffet, women will serve themselves. They'll make sure everyone is straight, but they'll serve themselves last.
So I think we have a clear idea is that literally, if we're going to tackle hormone health and reduce our risk of developing fibroids, we have to look at our lifestyle in totality. So it's about diet. It's about making sure that we eat well. It's about making sure that we explore what we're putting on our bodies and what we're inhaling. And it's about sleep and stress as well. So we have to look at the totality of it all.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Definitely. So I guess back to your program. So how does it work with your program? So how long is it? Is it one-to-one group sessions, or how does it all work?
So at the moment, I'm working with women on a one-to-one basis. Okay. I haven't really gone into group programs yet, because I just feel like I'd rather give fewer women that more personalized attention. But generally, I work with women on an 8 to 10 week basis, and that covers roughly 2 cycles. So it's just an opportunity to, you know, in the first cycle, see what's going on, start to make some habit changes, shift some habits that aren't necessarily ideal, start to add in better habits. And then in the second cycle, we start to see what changes are coming, and then make tweaks and add things if the client is ready to make progress. And it's all about, I really look at the client on an individual basis, and it's all about the level of support that they need. So some clients, they kind of really want me to be with them every step of the way, whereas other clients, they're happy for me to send them recommendations and just have check-ins, bi-weekly check-ins.
Okay, that sounds really good. And I guess the only other thing I wanted to ask about your program is, so I think research suggests that roughly about 25% or 30% of women with fibroids also have endometriosis. So I wondered if your approach would be different for a woman who has both fibroids and endometriosis.
Yeah, I think that's such a great question, because, you know, the common thread between fibroids and endometriosis is estrogen dominance. Whereas, you know, fibroids tend to be, they're located around the reproductive organs. Endometriosis can be systemic. I mean, I've heard stories of some women having endometrial plugs in their lungs, in their nose. So you have to look at the individual, and their situation. Mm-hmm. But generally, I would say that with a woman with endometriosis, I'd be also looking at pain management.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, it depends on the level of endometriosis that they have. I was recently working with someone with stage 4 endometriosis. So okay. A lot of the work was about really high quality pain management and reducing inflammation.
So your approach would be different. So it's just slightly different.
Yeah.
If people wanted to find out more about your different programs, where can they find out more about your different programs, and how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you can email me. My email address is lenise@eatlovemove.com. Email me, and I offer a free hormone health review that lasts about 30 minutes. So it's an opportunity just to have a confidential chat about what's going on, about any symptoms that you're having around your fibroids. And, you know, I would offer some really practical information. And then, you know, if the individual wants to work with me, then we talk about how we could take that forward in that conversation.
Okay, great stuff. So what I'll do is I'll put links and your email address in the show notes so that people have all that information.
Okay, great.
Just to finish off, really just some of your personal reflection. So I guess you must see quite a few women with fibroids. So I wondered if there are any kind of common themes or challenges that you've noticed that women with fibroids kind of discuss with you. Just wondered if you could share what some of those challenges are.
I think something that's quite common is how tricky it's been for these women to get a diagnosis or for their doctors to take them seriously. Mm. And you know, that I find that's just so troubling, that, you know, women are going to see their GPs and they're getting told that, you know, it's all in their head or it's normal. Or they should expect to have some sort of, they should expect pain when they're menstruating. And it's just simply not true. And it's one of my personal missions for women to understand that pain isn't normal. And if they're experiencing pain or discomfort, that they should go to see their GPs. And if they're not satisfied with the answer that they're getting, then they should get a second opinion, a third opinion, a fourth opinion, and that they should really advocate for themselves and not accept an answer that they're dissatisfied with.
Definitely, definitely. And we hear that a lot as well, that women just feel like they're not being listened to by their doctors. So we just hope that that will change. Challenges that you notice that women sort of raise with you?
I'd say, you know, with fibroids specifically, there is a lot of, you know, it's about managing the discomfort. So it can be, you know, depending on the size of the fibroid and the location, you know, you can have issues where, you know, the fibroid is pressing on the bladder.
Yeah.
So you've got to really manage. It's not just about what they're eating and their lifestyle. It's also about, you know, what can you do to help the individual woman feel more comfortable? So some of the things that I do, I talk about bladder training.
Okay.
And, you know, because depending on the time of the month and the level of inflammation. You know, you can have the fibroid pushing down on the bladder all day and all night and mm-hmm. making them incontinent. You go into, you know, getting them to go empty their bladder at least, you know, if not every hour, every 2 hours. So then you get to a state where their bladder isn't overly full, even though the fibroid is pressing on it. And then you see the sleep disruption start to decrease.
Yeah, I think there's just so many different ways that fibroids impacts a woman's lifestyle, and I just think there's not really an appreciation of that. So I find that a lot of the times people trivialize fibroids, and I think if people listen to this interview, they'll realize just how much fibroids impact the day-to-day lives of women.
We haven't really talked about the race aspect of it, but you know, fibroids are so prevalent with women. And, you know, there was a fascinating article from the New York Times that came out maybe last week or the week before about the difference in health outcomes in Black American women versus white American women, and how you have these Black women in the U.S. really having to advocate for themselves and really push for better outcomes. You know, even like someone like Serena Williams, she knows her body. She knows that she has this blood clotting disorder. And even after she's given birth and she can feel things going wrong and she's having a nurse trivialize her pain, and trivialize what's happening, and she's having to advocate for herself and fight. And I just it astounds me.
Yeah, it's really, really sad. And I think because fibroids tends to affect Black women slightly differently, so we get more aggressive fibroids, we get multiple fibroids, we develop fibroids at a younger age. I don't know, there just doesn't seem to be like a empathy. I don't know if empathy is the right word, but there just doesn't seem to be this appreciation that actually there are a lot of Black women with fibroids that have a completely different experience to white women with fibroids. And that's because of the fact that fibroids seem to be more aggressive in Black women, but we don't have that appreciation. We don't have that empathy from the health professionals. And I just wish that there was a bit more, it was spoken about more, so that there was an understanding and a more of awareness that it actually does affect Black women and white women slightly differently.
Yeah, I think conversations like this and are really important, and the forums that you're creating are really important, because this needs to be more widely known. It needs to be, fibroids need to be discussed in the same breath as PCOS, as endometriosis, and it's at the moment it's just not, and it needs to change.
Yeah, we hope that we can definitely change that. And so then just one more personal reflection from you, I guess. What has been the most maybe surprising thing that you've learned since you've delved into this area about either fibroids or just women's health in general?
I think, you know, it's the misinformation that's out there. You know, we've already touched a little bit on the, you know, the treatment of women from their GPs and the, you know, the advocacy that they have to do for themselves, but also kind of the misinformation that they're getting about their hormones and their, you know, fibroids from GPs and from medical specialists. I heard recently one woman say that her gynecologist told her that African women get fibroids because they eat too many yams and plantains.
Oh, goodness. I saw that girl on Twitter, and I was like, and they actually tagged us in the post. So we had to give a very diplomatic answer, but I was like literally banging my head on the on my table.
It's just, you know, you GPs and gynecologists and these kind of specialist consultants need to do better because women are depending on them for the right information and the right advice. And you hear stuff like this and it's just, you know, it's so frustrating because you just, you know, it's incorrect, but you also know that, you know, women with fibroids aren't being told that there's another way to manage their fibroids, that, you know, it's all about going down a really medicalized route where about leading to hysterectomy.
And that's a major issue. That came up a lot in our survey, that women felt actually forced to have a hysterectomy. And they didn't feel like they had, they didn't feel that all the options were presented to them, and they didn't feel they had an informed, they could make an informed decision about their clinical treatment. So I think that's another discussion that needs to be had out there about just the way that people have seemed to be forced down one route, which is down the hysterectomy route.
Yeah, and you know, there's just the prevalence of hysterectomies. I think I read online that it's actually one of the top five surgeries that are performed in the US.
Yeah, which is really scary. Really, really scary.
Really.
Okay, great. Well, Lynise, thank you so much for your time today and a really interesting discussion. So before we go, just to maybe to remind people of how they can get in touch with you, your website details.
Yeah, so my website is www.eatlovemoo.com. You can go onto my website, sign up for my newsletter, or drop me an email to get in touch, find out a bit more about my services and what I do.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. And hopefully we'll get you back on here again in the near future to talk about some other topics.
Thank you so much. I would love to do that.
Great. Thank you. You take care.
Wow, what an informative and insightful discussion I had with Lynise. I really enjoyed that discussion, which really allowed us to delve deeper into the issues around fibroids, hormones, diet, and lifestyle. If you have any questions whatsoever for Lynise or you have a comment, please do leave them in the comment section below the podcast. Or alternatively, you can visit Lynise's website or send her an email. I will leave all Lynise's contact details in the show notes so that you can contact her if you should decide that you want to contact her directly. Once again, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you again next week. Take care. Bye-bye.